One morning, without warning, Joseph K. wakes to find strangers in his bedroom. Two men in ill-fitting clothes inform him he's under arrest, but refuse to say why. They help themselves to his breakfast, rifle through his belongings, and treat his private space like their office. An inspector arrives, sits in K's favorite chair, and rearranges items on his nightstand with casual indifference, as if reorganizing someone's life were perfectly routine. When K demands to know the charges, the inspector offers only cryptic advice. Think less about us and more about yourself. Then comes the truly absurd part. K is under arrest, but he's free to go to work at the bank and continue his normal life. How can you be arrested yet free? This paradox launches K into a nightmare where nothing makes sense, where his ordinary bedroom transforms into a courtroom, and where his identity shifts from respected professional to accused criminal, all while maintaining an air of mundane normality that makes everything more terrifying. K's first interrogation occurs in a cramped tenement attic, packed with spectators treating it as entertainment. The oppressive air nearly causes him to faint, a physical manifestation of the psychological weight crushing him. In defiance, K delivers a scathing speech, snatching the magistrate's notebook as if contaminated, declaring it a closed book. Yet the court doesn't punish this outburst. Officials simply warn he's flung away the advantages an interrogation offers. The court never confronts K directly, but allows him to entangle himself through his own actions. When K returns on Sunday, the courtroom has transformed into the usher's living quarters. The boundaries between public and private, between judicial proceedings and everyday life, have dissolved. The court exists everywhere and nowhere, infiltrating every corner of K's existence while remaining maddeningly inaccessible. K discovers corruption woven throughout the court system. Law books on a courtroom table are actually pornographic picture books, a shocking fusion of legal authority and sexual exploitation. The usher's wife endures regular harassment from Bertold, a law student, with her husband's approval because Bertold will probably rise to great power yet. The examining magistrate sends her silk stockings as supposed payment for cleaning. Officials accept bribes, positions pass through family connections, and cases are decided through personal favors. At the painter Titorelli studio, Kay finds a door behind the bed leading directly into law court offices, another collapsed boundary between private and official spheres. What makes this corruption truly insidious is its normalization. No one questions these arrangements. They simply adapt. Even Kay gradually accepts the court's bizarre logic, strategizing to navigate its corruption rather than challenging its legitimacy. The true horror lies in how systems of power, however corrupt, come to seem inevitable. Kay hires Dr. Huld, a lawyer claiming court connections, but his methods prove as baffling as the court itself. Huld insists reform is madness. One must adapt oneself to existing conditions because change risks destruction. His defense consists of endless speeches and vague assurances, with no visible progress after months. The futility becomes clear through Block, a tradesman who's been Huld's client for 5 years. Once successful, Block now lives in a tiny room, having spent his fortune on his case. Despite hiring 6 lawyers, his case has barely moved. In a humiliating scene, Block kneels beside Huld's bed, desperately seeking information, only to be told a judge suggested his case had actually not begun yet after 5 years. Witnessing this degradation, Kay sees clients reduced to the lawyer's dog, willing to crawl under the bed as if into a kennel and bark if ordered. He dismisses Huld and attempts his own defense, but this proves equally futile. The court's procedures remain opaque, its officials inaccessible, its judgments arbitrary. Defense becomes meaningless in a system where guilt is presumed and procedures are designed not to determine truth, but to exhaust the accused into submission. A prison chaplain tells Kay a parable. A man from the country seeks admittance to the law, but is told by a doorkeeper he cannot enter yet. The man waits his entire life before the door, bribing the doorkeeper with everything he owns. As death approaches, he asks why no one else has come. The doorkeeper replies, "No one but you could gain admittance through this door, since this door was intended only for you. I am now going to shut it." The parable encapsulates the novel's core. The law remains perpetually inaccessible, yet exerts absolute power. The man wastes his life waiting for permission that never comes, only to discover the door was meant exclusively for him. The chaplain offers multiple interpretations, demonstrating how meaning itself becomes elusive. Kay concludes that the analysis turns lying into a universal principle, a system where truth isn't merely hidden, but actively distorted, where every statement contains its own contradiction, where justice becomes indistinguishable from deception.
On Kay's 31st birthday eve, two men in frock coats arrive to execute him. They meticulously fold his clothing, bureaucratic precision persisting even in death. At an abandoned quarry, they position Kay against a boulder. One draws a butcher's knife, passing it above Kay, apparently expecting him to plunge it into his own breast. When he refuses, they seize him and thrust the blade deep into his heart, turning it twice. With his dying breath, Kay utters, "like a dog," as if the shame would outlive him. After a year trapped in the court's labyrinth, Kay dies without dignity or understanding. What haunts most is his complicity. He accompanies them willingly, allows them to position him. The court's victory lies not in killing Kay, but in making him accept his own destruction as just. In his final moments, he glimpses someone in a distant window with outstretched arms. A friend? Help? One person or all mankind? This ambiguous vision offers fleeting connection, but arrives too late.
Kafka's vision has become our reality. We navigate automated systems, impenetrable algorithms, and corporate hierarchies that mirror Kay's frustrating journey. Credit scores, content moderation, HR procedures, we're constantly judged by inaccessible standards, subject to decisions we can't appeal. The novel functions as political allegory, religious parable, psychological study, and philosophical probe, with each interpretation revealing new depths. Yet Kafka offers more than despair. By exposing these systems' absurdity, he creates possibility for resistance. Kay's tragedy stems from gradually accepting the court's logic, surrendering to its authority, and internalizing its judgments. Perhaps salvation lies in refusing that acceptance, insisting on justice, transparency, and human dignity, even when these values seem hopelessly naive. Kay's final words, "like a dog," express his ultimate failure to maintain humanity against dehumanizing forces. Kafka's challenge? Can we do better? Can we face existence's incomprehensible nature without surrendering to shame? Can we create meaning and justice in a world designed to deny both? We may not escape the trial of existence, but we might face it on our own terms.